I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. They've been called the fourth branch of government and the enemy of the state. Journalists who strive not to be the story are finding themselves in the spotlight this week. Today, our media critics analyze the blow-up from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo towards NPR host Mary Louise Kelly. And we'll discuss the tweet that earned a Washington Post reporter a suspension, but has many fellow journalists crying foul. Then, like Kansas City, there's more to San Francisco than its football team. We'll join KQED's talk show In Progress to discuss affordable housing, immigration, and yeah, that Super Bowl thing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Reporters don't typically like becoming part of the story, but that's what happened last week when NPR host Mary Louise Kelly was thrust into the national spotlight after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo became upset over questions Kelly was asking about Ukraine. The interview was cut off, and Pompeo cursed Kelly, then challenged her to find Ukraine on a map. Since then, the State Department has denied another NPR reporter press credentials to travel with the Secretary of State on a trip to Europe. The episode is raising all manner of questions about the role of reporters and how the Trump administration has responded. The president himself appears to be backing Pompeo in his encounter with Mary Louise Kelly. Our media critics are in the house to address this issue and the media's coverage of the big game coming up this weekend, which is called, if you haven't heard, the Super Bowl. The media critics are Melinda Henneberger. She's an editorial writer and columnist at the Kansas City Star. Melinda, welcome back.
Thank you.
Ryan Famuliner is the news director at sister station KBIA in Columbia, where he also works with the MU School of Journalism. Ryan, nice to have you.
Happy to be here.
Peggy Lowe is here. She's on the investigative team at KCUR. Peggy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Melinda, we're going to talk about the Mary Louise Kelly incident in some detail here, but I think it's fair to say, based on my own career in journalism, that becoming part of the story tends to be a pretty uncomfortable place for almost any journalist. Am I right about that?
Oh, absolutely. No
Why
question.
Is that? Yeah.
Well, we were trained in the old days. You could have something happen like happened to Mary Louise Kelly, and you would never utter a peep about it. And I'm so glad that this all came out, not because it makes Mary Louise Kelly part of the story, but because she really was able to shine a light on an important aspect of the behavior and character of our Secretary of State.
And what an awkward position for her to be in. The Secretary of State saying, here's a map of the world, point to Ukraine. And none of the countries were obviously named in this map. It was a kind of a strange map.
I love maps. So my first reaction was, I want to get an unmarked map, so I'll be ready if I ever get to interview Mike Pompeo. But you would only have an unmarked map like that if this was your go-to parlor trick to humiliate people you want to humiliate. Yeah. And they did pick the wrong person.
Yeah.
Mary Louise
Kelly
knows the world. She really does.
Peggy.
She has a master's degree in European studies from Cambridge. Way to go, Pompeo. You picked the wrong person.
You know, Ryan, how shocking did you find this whole incident as you read about it as a fellow member of the NPR family?
Yeah. Like you said earlier, it's this type of stuff does happen. Ultimately, it was like sort of a form of bullying and trying to, you know, demonstrate some power and authority over Mary Louise Kelly, which obviously Secretary of State Pompeo does not have over her as a journalist. She's able to ask whatever questions she wants to ask, as she says, in the public interest. That's what she viewed in pursuing these questions. You know, she describes this glare she got at the end of the interview, which I know I've had a few times over the years. Mm-hmm. But I haven't had I haven't experienced personally this sort of berating activity afterward, but it's not something that I've heard other journalists who have experienced things like this before. Maybe not the map thing. The map thing does kind of take it over the top. There was also the moment where after this all happened in the fallout, Pompeo comes back and implies that she maybe pointed to Bangladesh, which makes absolutely no sense based on
Belarus, as you mentioned, maybe, but not Bangladesh.
Yes, Exactly. There's just no way.
But Peggy, we are talking here about the Secretary of State of the United States of America. This is not just some source, some legislative aide to a state senator in Topeka. This is the Secretary of State.
Exactly. And maybe he's too used to his role from Kansas to speak of Topeka, because, of course, Mike Pompeo is from Kansas.
Right.
But I thought it was so interesting that the debate afterwards was about whether or not Mary Louise Kelly played fair. Clearly, she did. They had she had talked with Pompeo's aides the night before about the parameters of the interview, as you do oftentimes.
Explain that to our listeners, because that kind of give and take might be new to some people, but typically a press secretary for someone like the Secretary of State will reach out to a reporter who scheduled an interview and say, hey, there's 10,000 things you might ask the Secretary of State. Can you give us just a range of topics you might cover, right?
Yes, that's true. And it used to not be as true. Actually, Melinda and I were talking about this on Facebook this week. Anymore, it seems that PR people get to set these parameters of time, set the parameter of issues. They want questions, prepared questions beforehand, and it drives me insane, but it's kind of the currency these days. So that was set out by Mary Louise Kelly and the State Department. Here are the topics we're going to talk about.
The topics, but not the questions, just to be really
right.
clear. She did not list off the questions, but she said, I want to talk about Ukraine, I want to talk about Iraq, right?
Right, and it shouldn't have been a surprise to Secretary of State, because he should actually be ready and open for any question that is posed by a journalist, because he is a public official.
And it's not only that, you're so right, but any reputable journalist in the world on any point of that unmarked map would have asked the question about Ukraine. In the middle of the impeachment, there was no way he was not going to get that question. So you really have to wonder whether is he that thin-skinned, or was that a performance for his boss, who loves anyone in his employ who takes on the media?
So no question in your mind, Melinda, this was fair game by Mary Louise Kelly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It would have been journalistic malpractice had she not asked that question,
which was very much
in the news.
The notion, Melinda, that she had an exchange with the press secretary or whoever it was for Mike Pompeo and said, hey, I want to talk about this topic and this topic. How common is that in your experience? Just so our listeners are keeping up with us here.
As Peggy said, it's more and more common that they really want to know if you're a blood relation of the principal before they give you access. I mean, it's gotten to an absurd degree. Mm-hmm. But it's very common that they want to know. It's less, if you handle it right, you don't agree to put certain things off the off the table.
And that's what Mary Louise Kelly said, but there was never an agreement that anything was off the table.
Right.
Because it's like you mentioned, Peggy, earlier, it's rational to want to know sort of what have a range of things you might talk about. Because you will, if the subject is doing some, they want to do some preparation, be prepared to talk about what you think you're going to talk about.
Right.
But yeah, I Mary Louise, basically Pompeo came back with three things that he pointed out in his statement afterward about things that he thought again, Bangladesh, which obviously seems like that can't be possible. What you're talking about here, which is that she didn't notify him that she was going to talk about Iran, which again, there are emails to prove that she notified an aide before the interview. And then he also complained that this conversation after the interview was actually off the record, which Mary Louise Kelly said that was not the case. The only agreement was that she would be going to his private quarters and the recorder
not
wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And anybody who talks to journalists more than once in their life knows that if you're not using the phrase off the record, overtly the phrase off the record, and the journalist is agreeing to be off the record, you're not off the record.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Pompeo's been around the block a few times when it comes to the way journalists operate.
And this is his MO with journalists. He lost his temper with our reporter, Jonathan Shorman, when our abandonment of the Syrian Kurds was in the news, asked about our abandonment of the Syrian Kurds, and he lost his temper and called the question insane. He behaved the same way with some student journalists.
But Peggy, I'm wondering about to what extent this issue has been compounded by the fact now that the State Department is refusing to provide press credentials to allow another NPR reporter to make this trip to Europe with the Secretary of State in the coming days. And how is NPR reacting to this?
Right. So what you're talking about is the fact that Michelle Kellerman, a longtime diplomatic reporter has been denied the ability to go on this trip with the State Department. And everyone is seeing that as it is, as retaliation for what happened with Mary Louise Keller. Kelly, rather. Mm-hmm. I think NPR has reacted really well and above board and said, you know, our Mary Louise Kelly's interview speaks for itself. It was ethical. And the way they're retaliating is not cool at all. I heard Steve Inskeep sort of give an attagirl to Michelle Kellerman yesterday. He was interviewing her about what was going on later, and the out cue was something like, Michelle Kellerman, one of the best in the business, you know, that kind of thing. I thought it was great.
You know, Ryan, I'm wondering about the fallout for this, for the Fourth Estate, for the press corps. You read surveys, journalists not held in very high regard by anybody these days. Here we are, four journalists stomping our feet over this. A, does the public care about this, and B, do we stand to be hurt by this as the public perhaps chooses not to side with the media? If they don't care.
I have been thinking about this. I mean, one thing that's going to probably we've already experienced here is that access could be limited for NPR, particularly or other journalists. I think that's an issue. That's an issue at many levels of government at the moment. Anyway, I mean, our Governor Greitens here in Missouri basically did no interviews during his short tenure as governor. Just did all his stuff over Facebook. So there's that element of access that I think is inherent in the Fourth Estate. Like, it's important that we have access to these key sources to understand what they're thinking. Mary Louise Kelly in her New York Times op-ed talked about that. That's all she's trying to do, is get information for the public. That's her job. Mm-hmm. Her job is not to throw down some gauntlet. Her job is not to score political points. The problem is, there is kind of, in the media landscape that we live in now, I don't say journalism, but the media landscape that we live in right now, scoring points has a lot of currency. Scoring points is something that is rewarded in a lot of ways that are sort of counterintuitive to the mission of journalism, to this mission that Mary Louise Kelly's talking about, like trying to inform the public. So I think, like, this ends up, this is why you said earlier that Pompeo picked the wrong person. He basically tried to lump her in with some sort of media analyst or somebody trying to score points, but she doesn't fit into that category of people that do exist out in the world in the media sphere at the moment.
Melinda Henneberger, what's to stop? I guess where I'm going here, what's to stop the Trump administration from making this a regular practice? If the media isn't held in high regard, if the public at large isn't really outraged by mistreatment of reporters, then what's to stop the Trump administration from making it a common practice?
Well, I think they will make it a common practice if you know, they'll get away with it. I don't think anybody in public life ever lost a voter by complaining about the media, and that's on left and right. Trump has obviously taken it to a whole new level. Access has been shrinking my whole time in journalism, and Peggy and I were talking about this too. You know, you public servants used to believe that they had to answer to the public, and they no longer believe that. And I think the public is wrong to applaud those efforts to have less and less access. No one, you know, the public does not seem outraged by that. They should be, because we work for them. But it isn't only Trump. What's to stop them? In the end, Trump will stop them, because he can't resist speaking to us. So he has been, in fact, far more available to the press than Barack Obama was, because he can't quit.
can't help himself.
Peggy, yes. Lowe, to what extent do you sort of fret, you know, a little bit about this idea that it access, as Melinda just said, is being continually restricted as the years pass, and the ability for us sometimes to connect with Republicans in particular has become more difficult?
I fret about it a lot, and here's the thing I worry about most. I watch the younger journalists, for instance, in my newsroom. This is just how we do it now, right? They now send all the questions over and do all the work with the PR people.
By email.
By email. They do stories where they never talk to a human being. And things like that really, really worry me. I want to say this too, though. I think it's really good that we're talking about this. I think the media has done a bad job in the past of explaining what we do, and that we're trying to do this for the public. And Mary Louise Kelly's op-ed in the Times was so great, and I tweeted it out before your show. She said, journalists don't sit down with senior government officials in the service of scoring political points, to Ryan's point. We do it in the service of asking tough questions on behalf of our fellow citizens and then sharing the answers or lack thereof with the world. Yeah. So if we can keep getting back to that, I think that's just critical.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with our media critics this morning about a range of issues affecting reporters. Melinda Henneberger from The Star is here. Ryan Femuliner with KBIA is here. And Peggy Lowe from KCUR is as well. Different topic. A Washington Post reporter was suspended and then reinstated just the other day for tweeting out a story that was from a different media outlet and a story she was not involved with about Kobe Bryant. The tweet came shortly after Kobe Bryant's death on Sunday, and it linked viewers to a story that took a deep dive into the rape case that Bryant was involved with years before. In reinstating her, the Post said the tweet was ill-timed, but not a direct violation of the paper's social media policy. The reporter, Felicia Somes, appears to still be upset about this. Does she have a point, Melinda?
I think she does. I should say I know Felicia from her time working together at the Post. I was really shocked by this whole thing. Yes, you can question her timing, but if you know, as everybody at the Post does, that Felicia herself is a survivor of rape, then you say, you know, the questions about timing, that's a concern that a survivor, that's a stop sign a survivor might well blow right through.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was upset myself that management's first concern was not for Felicia's safety, as she was getting many, many vile threats.
For having made that tweet.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
She stayed in a hotel Sunday night because
right.
of all those things.
Rather than, there was absolutely no, you can argue about whether she should have tweeted that at that moment, but you really cannot argue that the first concern should have been for the safety of their reporter. And understanding sexual violence doesn't just mean standing up for your story about rape. It means standing up for your employee who has had that experience and understanding what that implies.
Ryan, you work in management. Do you think she should have been suspended?
So, honestly, I don't know enough about the policies to know what their process is for handling something like this. It definitely seemed brash, that decision. And I've seen that she also got some messages from her editor basically saying this is hurting the reputation of the paper. This isn't helping the paper. That seems a very ill-advised approach, particularly given the stuff you've just talked about, Melinda. But regardless, that's an ill-advised approach. Like an email with that or a text with that sort of message, this sort of situation is a conversation with your reporter to figure out what they're doing, why this is happening, and how, as you're saying, how you can be with them in this moment, particularly given her personal history.
You know, the Post, I should point out, is headed by the legendary Marty Baron of
right.
Spotlight fame, and he's a man of considerable reputation in the industry, Peggy.
But this was a managing editor who made that call,
okay,
someone
right.
under him. And let me also just point out that this tweet, she didn't come down on either side. I don't know the woman, and I didn't even know she was a survivor of sexual assault. She offered no comment. All she had was the headline of a story done in 2016 by the Daily Beast. I thought it was pretty appalling that the Post did this to her.
You know, the Washington Post Guild has issued a statement saying it's disappointed that the Post statement did not include an apology to her. Mm-hmm. So this story may be not completely in the can yet, Peggy.
And she called out Marty Baron.
Right, she did.
This reporter did afterwards. What's
and
that
it
about?
Was Marty Baron who wrote
the
email that
right.
Ryan was talking about, saying, Felicia, stop. You're hurting the ability of your colleagues to do their work. I do not understand what he's talking
yeah.
about. Mm-hmm. I think that shows, spotlight or not, a lack of understanding of all that it means
right.
to be a survivor
yeah.
of that. And I think she is made of steel to then, after being reinstated, say, I still want to hear from Marty what this mm-hmm. was about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not a real great move for job security in an industry that's obviously struggling right
well,
now.
Well, there's also mm-hmm. just, to your question earlier, should she have been suspended, one of the challenges for any news organization is how do you handle social media presence for your reporters? Because
mm-hmm.
even a policy, like we're wondering whether it was against their, they said it wasn't against their policy, but these policies on their face are very hard to enforce or hard to even craft, because it's either going to be reliance on the opinion of an editor, which it sounds like it was in this situation, whether this should happen, which is very, very subjective, or you're going to have to have a policy that encompasses every possible activity you could ever do on social media, which is near impossible to actually describe. So it's really hard to but at the same time, does a news organization own a journalist's ability to exist in other spaces that aren't their publication? Right. It's a big thing that journalists are going to have to grapple with, and news organizations and managers are going to have to grapple with for a long time.
Point. They first said that it was because she was talking about something outside her subject area, and the answer to that was correctly, if people were suspended for that, there would be no one putting out the paper tomorrow.
And there were so many other advocates out there that day. I was watching this unfold on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
So many sexual assault survivors saying, hey, if you're triggered, here's where you go, here's who to call. You know, people were trying to offer sort of that safety of that breaking news story that day.
Hey, we still have a little bit of time left. I want to turn to a final topic here, which is Super Bowl coverage. Obviously, some great journalism being done in connection to the big game on Sunday. But I also can't help but suggest that some of it appears to be coverage for coverage's sake and a little bit lame. Everyone trying to get all kinds of stories in about the Chiefs, no matter how good or not so good they are. What's your sense, Ryan?
I mean, I loved the story y'all did about the mob coming down. I thought that was really great done, Casey. That was a terrific story. I think those are the stories that I appreciate, the ones that actually related to something that matters.
Different you didn't know before.
Because honestly, like, I don't really care that much about the ticket prices or that kind of thing or the weather. I'm not going to be there. I agree. There's a lot going on. Now, that said, I grew up in this area. I'm a Chiefs fan my whole life. And I've also just tried not to be reading much this week because I'm just too nervous. So I don't have a whole lot else to say about this because I've just been trying to put myself on blinders until the game's over.
I got 20 seconds, Peggy. How's the media doing when it comes to Super Bowl coverage here in town?
Okay, this is going to be controversial, but I'm giving a lot of it a pass. This town loves its Chiefs. It hasn't happened for 50 years. Okay, so have some of the stories been lame? Oh, yeah. But you know what? There's a huge appetite for this.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my media critics today. That was the voice of Peggy Lowe on the investigative team here at KCUR. Ryan Femuliner from KBIA over in Columbia. He's the news director. Belinda Henneberger, my former colleague on the Star editorial board. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks.
You know, next, a joint broadcast with yours truly and Michael Krasny. He's the host of a similar program on member station KQED in San Francisco. We'll talk Super Bowl teams and Super Bowl cities. When we return, the voice you hear won't be mine. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Krasny, host of Forum on KQED in San Francisco, and the 49ers may be playing in Miami on Sunday, but there's another city on the mind of Bay Area football fans, and that's Kansas City, home of the Chiefs, the team that stands between the Niners and a 6th Super Bowl trophy. And just like there's more to San Francisco than the Golden Gate Bridge and cable cars, there's more to Kansas City than barbecue and jazz. And so joining us in mid-broadcast of his program is Steve Kraske, host of Up to Date on NPR member station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. And we thought we would offer his listeners a snapshot of life here, and he could do the same for us. And hi, Steve.
Michael, so nice to be with you. Welcome.
Good to have you. Welcome to you. And you can join, that is in Kansas City and San Francisco Bay Area, this conversation, whether you are in either of those areas that are facing off on Sunday in the Super Bowl. You can give us a call right now. Let us know what you think. Where the Super Bowl is concerned, the number to call, toll free, is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And Steve, in addition to having names that sound similar and also being products of the University of Wisconsin, you and I share a number of other things. We're both professors, but I suspect we're rooting for different teams here. I'd like to know what you think initially of your team's chances, so we can hear in the Bay Area that, but also maybe begin by telling us how the fans in your area are expressing their excitement over the big game on Sunday.
Well, Michael, just for the record, when this conversation is over, I guarantee you'll be on rooting for the Chiefs because there's just no way your team's going to pull this game off on Sunday. But you got to keep in mind here, for you guys and the success of your teams under Joe Montana and Steve Young for so many years, you guys have been to the Super Bowl a lot. This is a once-in-a-50-year shot for Kansas City fans out here, Michael. And I got to tell you, the city is simply going bananas. Buildings lit up in red and gold. cold at night, all kinds of parties being planned, people making travel plans to go to Miami. It's really a crazy time here and so exciting for this city to finally be back in the big game.
Well, we're excited here, too, despite all the many wins in the past. And I don't know about rooting for Kansas City. I got to tell you, when I think about this team, this 49ers team, I mean, Jimmy Garoppolo, for example, has been put down by Jeff Rosen, your columnist there. There was some back and forth that was taking shots. Each our own Scott Osler was doing the same in the Chronicle against Kansas City. Some of the stuff was pretty funny. But Jeff Rosen said, yeah, Jimmy Garoppolo, a backup to Tom Brady. Come on, Jimmy Garoppolo has really proven himself. And we've got also a secret weapon, not so secret, like in Raheem Mostert, who ran 220 yards, and did four touchdown scores back against the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, he makes me nervous. Yeah, he's terrific.
He should make you nervous.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, I have to really give credit where credit is due. Your quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, is really superb. I think it's a real matchup of quarterbacks here.
Well, it is, and I think on that front, we have the edge. You guys would have the edge in probably other facets of the game, but Mahomes is incredible. And I got to tell you, maybe my views of this game are particularly slanted because back in 2018, the home opener for my team, the Chiefs, was against the San Francisco 49ers. It was Pat Mahomes' first season as a full-time starter, and Garoppolo was the quarterback playing in Arrowhead Stadium that day. And we won that game going away, 38-27. Mahomes was 24-38, 314 yards, three touchdowns, zero interceptions. Garoppolo played a good game too, but it wasn't enough. So I've seen these two teams match up close and personal, and we came away ahead. But your defensive front four, your rush is impressive. You have one of our former players on the line with you now, and that makes me I'm a little anxious about that.
Well, you better get anxious about your pass defense, too. I mean, the fact of the matter is we've got a pretty strong defense going for us, and I mean, your pass protection particularly.
Right.
It's going to be a good matchup. In fact, the gamblers are giving it 1.5 points, I think, for Kansas City. But maybe at the end of this segment, you and I will have the opportunity to make predictions, something I almost never like to do, but I'm going to do it here today. And we'll also, of course, hear from our listeners in the course of this segment we're talking about. Did you know, by the way, before making it to the NFL, your coach, Andy Reid, once sold hot dogs as an assistant at San Francisco State?
No, you're kidding. I did not know that. No. But what a great guy he is, and has such a loyal backing here, and he's the big sympathy factor for so many Kansas Cityans because he's obviously never won the big game before, despite having one of the most stellar coaching records in the history of the NFL. So everyone in this city is rooting hard for Andy, and I think he's got a lot of fans around the country who are in his corner as well.
We got good guys as coaches on
Absolutely.
Both teams. We're worried about Tevin Coleman, though. He dislocated his shoulder. He's still on the sidelines, but I don't know, with a fractured shoulder, how likely he is to play. So there's that kind of wild card in all of this as well. But it's going to be an exciting game, and we're looking forward to it. And you're painting the town red there, aren't you?
Boy, there is absolutely no question about it, and it's going to be a blast. Well, Michael, we have some other things that I wanted to talk about here about Kansas City and its issues and what you guys are up against out on the Bay there. And I should just say that I love San Francisco. I just think it's one of the great American cities. I've lived out in the Stanford area for a year once and know the area a little bit and just think the world of San Francisco. But a couple of issues obviously are you know, everyone's has their share of concerns. One of the big ones is affordable housing. You know, a lot of Kansas City think we've got a big problem with that issue out here, but given the real estate prices and what I was looking at last night about the San Francisco area, my jaw dropped. Our problems here when it comes to affordable housing may pale in comparison, Michael.
They do pale, and we should say we were just discussing in the first segment of our opening hour a proposition that just went down to defeat, Senate Bill 30, which was put forward by a state senator, which 50, I did say it right the first time, and would have made a big difference in housing, but there were problems with concerns about gentrification and concerns about not enough affordable housing and all that. We have figures here that boggle the mind. The median two-bedroom in San Francisco is $1.35 million.
$1.35 million for a two-bedroom home?
That's right. For a two, and the medium rent for a one-bedroom in San Francisco is $4,380 a month. So, $3,500. So you guys are looking pretty good, maybe even though you have a bad crunch there.
Well, I hope your listeners will consider moving out to the heartland here, Michael, because I can get you in a really nice house here in the Kansas City area for a couple hundred thousand bucks, and might even be three or four bedrooms worth of house for that amount of money.
I don't know if all these Democrats in San Francisco would necessarily be lured to. Kansas City is still pretty Republican, isn't it, for the most part?
Well, no. The city itself is a Democratic enclave, but we are surrounded by Republicans on both sides of the state line, and that has made some issues really tough for mayors, for instance. Our last two mayors, Sly James and Quentin Lucas, both wanted to see the state legislature in Missouri, in Jefferson City, pass some gun restrictions to help us with an incredibly difficult homicide rate we have in the city. It's intractable. It's been around for years, 150 homicides a year, and the new mayor, Mayor Lucas, wants to see that drop to below 100. But one of the big things he thinks we need to do is to deal with the guns and how easily accessed they are here in Kansas City. But you can't get the Republican legislature in the state capitol to go along because the NRA is very much in control of that capitol. And so from that standpoint, on that kind of issue, being a Democratic enclave surrounded by Republicans is really tough stuff.
You're also, though, falling right between two red states. And the fact of the matter is that, like San Francisco Bay Area, there are concerns throughout Kansas City on both sides. And by the way, when we talk about the two sides of Kansas City, we have to think that there are two sides of the Bay Area. There's Santa Clara, where the football action has always been going on, and there's the whole San Francisco Bay Area in addition to that. But right now, immigration is in some ways maybe a bigger issue here because San Francisco is a sanctuary city, and certainly Kansas City is not.
Right. And, you know, it's an issue out here, but I don't think it's an issue like it is in California, where I think you have more immigrants than any other state in the country, Michael. Do I have
that's
that right?
Correct. That's
yeah.
right.
But here, it's not as big of issue. Missouri has one of the lowest population of unauthorized immigrants in the country, just 1% of the entire state's population. In Kansas, it's a little better, 2.6% of the state's population. But what's interesting to me about it is in Kansas, we've actually seen some counties out west, you know, Dodge City, the city that's known for gunfights in the Old West, is now a county that's a majority Hispanic. And the interesting thing to me, we've done shows on it here on Up to Date in Kansas City, the interesting thing to me is that that community has really done well with the influx of people of color in ways that you don't see very often. Very few problems. The city leaders adjusted to it very well. Economics might be at the root of that. A lot of the Hispanics working at the meatpacking plants out there, white folks leaving Western Kansas, now being replaced by Latinos who will take those jobs. So there is some convenience going on there. But having said it, it's interesting to me that we've seen this relatively speedy influx and transition in some Western Kansas communities, and they've pulled it off really beautifully, Michael. How about in California there?
Well, in California, immigration is not only because of the number of immigrants a major issue, but in San Francisco and in other cities throughout the state, there is sanctuary for those who come here undocumented or illegal, as one more often hears, particularly, I suppose, in Kansas City. Do you hear that word undocumented as much in Kansas City?
You do hear it, yes.
Yeah. I just wondered about that. But the fact is, here in California, we've got, well, let's just take San Francisco for the moment. Our mayor, London Breed, has come out against ICE and has come out pretty strongly against their incursions in one way or another, responded, in fact, to proposed ICE raids in San Francisco last June by saying, quote, "It is unconscionable that the federal administration is targeting innocent immigrant families with secret raids that are designed to inflict as much fear and pain as possible." Now, Kansas City may be more of a Democratic enclave, but I suspect that there are pretty different attitudes in that in terms of city officials, aren't there?
Well, Yes, and I was going to point out that as the good news I painted about Western Kansas, I should also point out that Chris Kobach, who's one of this country's leading crusaders against illegal immigration, has been really tough on that issue, intensely controversial, has been a top aide to President Trump and has had his ear on immigration matters. You know, he's running again statewide in Kansas and might have a pretty good shot at becoming the Republican nominee for governor later on this year. He just lost for U.S. Senate. He just lost a tough race for governor a couple of years ago. So, you know, the state of Kansas still might elevate someone like a Chris Kobach, who is so intensely controversial on this issue. And a lot of folks around the country and in California probably won't appreciate that a whole lot.
Well, there's a kind of history repeating itself there, isn't there? At the turn of the 20th century, meatpacking plants saw a big influx of workers from Mexico who wanted to take those really tough jobs. But that's gone through a whole metamorphosis. Immigrants are now filling jobs again with meat processing plants in recent decades, aren't they?
It's exactly what's happening out in Western Kansas, Michael. There's this big transition, and history very much repeating itself here. Here we are 100 years later going through almost an identical process. And again, the economic advantages of that perhaps have smoothed relations between people of color and whites in Western Kansas and made for a pretty harmonious gathering out there.
Well, we're going to bring you, our listeners, into this discussion. I just wanted to make one footnote here before we do. I know listeners may want to talk about the big game coming up or about comparisons or contrast between San Francisco Bay Area and Kansas City. I just wanted to mention that Scott Osler, who I talked about before, said we have, and you're a professor of journalism, I'm a professor of literature, but he was writing about our great literary heritage. He said San Francisco has Kerouac and Twain and Ferlinghetti, the Bay Area, Michael Chabon, Kansas City, people who write Hallmark greeting cards. But Jeff Rosen...
I saw that.
Well, Jeff Rosen came back with some good shots, though. Jeff Rosen said he defended Kansas City's literary chops, saying, you know, come on, Mark Twain's from Missouri. What did he maybe have, a cup of coffee in San Francisco? That's a bit of hyperbole to put it. But he mentions that Ernest Hemingway wrote for the Kansas City Star, which is true, of course.
You know, absolutely. And I worked for the Star for 33 years, and one of our proudest calling cards across the country, Michael, was this idea that we trained Ernest Hemingway. We, you know, back in the day, editors trained Ernest Hemingway in that short, concise writing style that he made so famous over the years and brought him so much fame in his career. He got his start doing that in the newsroom of the Kansas City Star, where I spent so many decades of my career.
Well, just tell Jeff Rosen, if you know him, don't call us Frisco. Hurricane used to say that over and over again.
You don't like that. I know you don't like that out there. Yeah.
It's all right by me, but Herb K. made it into a fetish. Let me get a caller on here from Berkeley. Daniel, join us.
Thank you very much, Michael. I wanted to, this question is for your admirably overconfident Kansas City host. sir, as the Chiefs are a great football team, and Kansas City is a great city, and the 49ers, great football team, San Francisco is a great city, are the Chiefs like a Kansas City team, unlike the San Francisco 49ers, which is a 49ers, Santa Clara, San Jose, way outside of San Francisco team?
Right. No, that's a great question. And I'll say that the Chiefs are very much a regional team, and so much interest in the team that extends up to Nebraska. There aren't any other NFL franchises any closer than Minneapolis, Denver. St. Louis used to have one, but obviously doesn't any longer. So very much a regional team. A woman on our sports commission was just on the show here this week. We were talking about the upcoming parade, the victory parade we're going to have in this town next week.
Wait a minute, you're going to have?
Oh, we're going to have after we win the game on Sunday. And what was interesting, what she was saying, is just a few years ago, the Royals won the World Series. She thinks the crowds for a victory parade for the Chiefs will be even larger because of the regional attention and interest in the team that extends so far and wide out here in the heartland of the country.
Well, our parade is probably going to be in San Francisco, according to former Mayor Willie Brown. Let's try to get one more caller on here.
Sure.
David from San Francisco, join us.
Hi, longtime listener, second-time caller. The first time I called you was the day after the Super Bowl when San Francisco lost to the Baltimore Ravens. I thought maybe it would be time to call before the Super Bowl. Three keys are the key to victory, I think. Turnover differential, taking the ball away more than the Chiefs do. Time management, which is something, the clock management of Andy Reid is not his best forte. and he's good for giving up points at the ends of both halves, and then third down conversions.
All right, David, thank you for that. And we get into the end of this discussion with Steve. And Steve, you want to make a prediction here?
Well, I think we're going to win 37-24, Michael. Bad news for you guys. But again, you've won enough Super Bowls out there. It's our turn out here. And we got Pat Mahomes, and you don't.
Yeah, but we're going to beat you by a couple of touchdowns. I'll just leave it at that. I don't like to make predictions, but we'll let that stand. And we might disagree on this, but this has been a very amicable conversation, and I thank you for this.
Well, Michael, we have a lot in common. I hope we can get together and have a cup of coffee sometime.
Yeah, we can maybe have some San Francisco French rebel or something along those lines. Thank you for joining us. I'm the host of KQED's Forum. It's been great talking with Steve and learning more about Kansas City from him. And it looks like we could be on a receiving end of some kind of deal here. It's it. Ice cream sandwiches and a recorded message of congratulations from KQED. You take that bet, Steve?
Well, I want something more than ice cream sandwiches, Michael. We're going to ship you some barbecue for winning this game, and you're going to come out way on the better end of that deal.
Okay. We'll look forward to some real Kansas City barbecue.
All the best, Michael.
Yeah, same to you. Good to have you on. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Coming up, Spencer and Brian and some hot talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend with the Super Bowl game coming up.
You gotta fight for your right to party. You gotta fight.
Oh, let's get going here. Spencer Hardwick is here. He's founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. Brian McTavish is back. He follows and writes about pop culture, and they're here to talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend, as if we need more fun stuff, because we have a football game at 5 o'clock Sunday afternoon, right, Spencer?
We do. Well, who's playing? Is there a game this weekend?
Is there a game this weekend? Yeah.
Very confusing.
You want to talk about a big party in connection with the Super Bowl coming up,
Steve,
here.
Steve, we have waited 50 years for this moment.
It's been a long time, Spencer.
And over the last 20 years, we've actually built a nice living room to put the party in. So come on down to KC Live
That's
this
right.
weekend for the game.
How crowded is that going to be on
it's
Sunday?
It's going to be nuts. We all love the Royals. Love 2015 and 2014 Royals. With all due respect, I think that this party is going to be even bigger than what you've seen with the Royals, just because we're a football town, we're a regional sporting team. But again, the big party, the biggest of all Super Bowl parties, probably in the country, is going to be down at KC Live. It's going to start at 12 p.m. We're going to hope that it ends at 1 or 2 in the morning. Everything, grill stations, hot alcoholic beverages, heaters around the block for those who are like, yeah, it's going to be cold. Families are welcome. Selfie stations and red Hawaiian leis for the first 300 guests. There's something for
they're going to go fast. That
exactly.
one's around.
Gone by 12:05 p.m.
So a big party on Sunday down at the Power and Light, right?
It's going to be phenomenal. Hope to see everybody down there, or more hopefully afterward.
On the planet dog, it's the dogs that are in charge and not the men. On the planet dog, it's the dogs that drive the cars and go to work. On the planet dog, it's the men that stay at home alone and drink the water from the toilets.
On the planet, I hate when dogs do that. Hate it, hate it, hate it.
Why?
It's because it's not a good. I just don't like
that. He's turning flesh red.
Well, dogs do what dogs do. And one thing
that from the toilet.
Your dog could do after it drinks water from the toilet, potentially, is the Barkay Puppy Bowl, the first of what I'm sure will be many Barkay Puppy Bowls, puppies and footballs, 11-3 Saturday at Berkeley Riverfront Park.
What's a puppy bowl?
I'm going to tell you, in this dog's world that we just live in, every year, you know, there's this ridiculously cute puppy Super Bowl televised right before the real Super Bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about a Kansas City version Saturday at Berkeley Riverfront Park, right? Puppies ages 3 to 9 months, must be current on vaccinations, are invited to hit the gridiron or the mini gridiron. I'm told that they'll separate the pups into four separate football games. And
what?
I think it'll be canine chaos or amusing chaos. Anyway, I'm told the winner from each contest will be named. God only knows how that will be determined.
How do you win a football game with dogs?
I think the cutest team will win. That would be what I would suggest. Every pup gets a goodie bag with a bandana. And adults get discounts on their alcoholic beverages. Get there at 11 to register. Bring the little puppy. Put a little jersey on him. Have a good time. It's Saturday. It's the day before. What if every puppy had a Chiefs jersey? That would be confusing to the ref. That would be very confusing. Because, well, not really, because the Chiefs are going to win, right?
Yes, that's
Spencer, tell me again. Just tell me in that voice.
Oh, they're going to win.
Which voice?
The voice that says they're going to win.
They're going to win.
They're definitely going to win.
All right.
There you go.
Not like that song. You just got to let it run for a bit. That's just a great tune.
It's so infectious. Yeah. Steve, have you ever been to a Great Gatsby party?
No.
I would highly recommend that everyone over the course of the next few years get to some type of fancy Great Gatsby type party, because Party Artie, done by the Nelson Atkins Museum, does this every year. They're one of the great avenues or opportunities you can really do that. So Party Artie this year means descending into the Valley of the Queens in splendor and discover the radiant beauty of ancient Egypt at Party Artie, Night of the Shining Sun, inspired by the featured exhibition, Queen Nefertiti, Eternal Egypt.
What does that have to do with Great Gatsby?
So it's the same type of elegant ballroom affair where there'll be a lot of great things to do. Some of my favorite things, late night treats provided by Shake Shack. Mm. We can have the debate about Shake Shack, In-N-Out, Winstead's, you know, Five Guys. We can do that a little bit later. Beer from Boulevard Brewing. Have you guys heard of the Quixotic company?
Yes.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yes. Cirque du Soleil, but done locally. Very, very well done.
They're going to be there.
They'll be there. Kansas City Ballet
is
going to
be performing.
They're always worth seeing. Exactly. It's quite a party. Now, it's a pretty high-dollar ticket, but from everyone who's gone, who I've spoken to, it's definitely worth every nickel.
That's this weekend on Saturday night at the Nelson Atkins, right?
8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Get right before the big game.
Sounds like fun.
Welcome to our house on Maple Avenue. See how we polish and we shine. We rearrange and realign. Everything is balanced and serene. Like chaos never happens if it's never seen. Every need we anticipate and fill.
I think we're talking about something from the Kansas City Rep here, Brian.
We are, as well we should from time to time. This is Fun Home. It's Kansas City Rep's take on the Tony Award-winning musical that's about the difficult relationship between a daughter and father. Mm. Final performances this weekend, today through Sunday. There's a 2 o'clock performance Sunday. No sweat. Go see Fun Home.
Oh, boy.
And then have fun when the
Chiefs
win.
Might be a few seats available for that one.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Spencer Theater, of course, at the UMKC Performing Arts Center. I could go on forever. I don't have forever, but let me try a little bit of info here. Inspired by comics creator Alison Bechdel's best-selling 2007 graphic novel memoir, in other words, a novel-length autobiographical comic book, Fun Home shares the story of Allison, little Allison, growing up in a terribly dysfunctional family that's trying as hard as it can to fit the cookie-cutter suburban dream. Everybody's doing just great, thanks. Nuclear family, but there's trouble. There's always trouble. There are big family secrets and confusions. Eventually, the truths that can set everyone free, more or less, perhaps. Well, I don't want to give away the ending, but ultimately, the story is about accepting who we really are on the inside, so we can be who we really are on the outside.
I agree with that.
Mm. I agree with that, too. I always agree with me. So anyway, check it out, because it was a comic book. It was a great comic book. It's a great stage play, great music, and the tussle between what's true and what's false. Pick the truth. Pick the light. Go to the light. Check out Fun Home this weekend at Spencer Theater at UMKC.
Very well said.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the good life. Welcome to the good life.
The wait is over.
Welcome to the good life.
And after all the talk, all I gotta say is,
welcome to the good life.
You're welcome. You're all welcome.
What do we have here, Spencer?
What is the good life? When I say that word, what does that mean to you all?
We're living it, man.
She's victory on Sunday. That's what the good life is.
How about you? What do you think?
It's a single by Kanye West in 2004.
What's that too?
Other than that, it's also an expo going on Friday and Saturday. This is the 2020 Good Living KC Expo, Kansas City's largest health living event with over 200 vendors, sponsors, classes, and healthy food options. Free for children under 12. And also, there's going to be a big celebrity there. I'm surprised that this person will be there, actually.
Really?
This Casey Wolf is going to be in the house. Yeah. And he's going to need to get on a plane and get to Miami on a red eye, I guess. Some of the workshops you can expect to see are what to expect when you're expecting stress, intermittent fasting, carb cycling, and shockwave therapy.
Ah.
I'm pretty intrigued by that shockwave therapy. So a lot to do. Get your life right and get your mind right before the big game tomorrow as well.
And finally today. Okay. Take us out.
Are you ready for the latest audience-inspiring, audience-awing, I should say, spectacular from the gravity-defying friends at Cirque du Soleil? Well, if you are, and I'm sure you are, then check out the world-class ice skating, dancing, and acrobatic spectacular. It's tonight through Sunday, 1 p.m. on Sunday, right? So you can still make the Super Bowl.
Okay.
It's at Sprint Center. This is going to be part of the fun. There's going to be Tears for Fears, Mad World, Rihanna's Diamonds, Radiohead's Creep, the Bee Gees. Yes, we'll be there in song. But basically, it tells the story of finding yourself again. The central character is named Axel. He plays the guitar and he finds the pick. Let's just put it that way.
People need to find themselves.
To fly through the air and do figure eights and get us to come watch.
Okay, that's Cirque du Soleil. That's coming up this weekend.
Yeah.
Here in town. That's Brian McTavish, Spencer Hardwick. Thank you both for a good list, guys. Chiefs.
Give me one. Go Chiefs.
There we go.
Chiefs, let's go.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. You can find previous episodes of our show, like my conversation with legendary sports activist Dr. Harry Edwards, on the link between athletics and social justice. Just go to KCUR.org. Tomorrow, The Magic of Mushrooms. One filmmaker explains how fungi are at the center of life, death, and the survival of our planet. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Engstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.